I think we're pretty good. I mean, I obviously made a couple of mistakes. I pulled a fastball in. I mean, when you pull a fastball in to a good left-handed hitter like that, he's going to do damage. So, but for the most part, I think I executed my game plan really well, and I was able to, you know, use my fastball the way I wanted to. I was able to use my off-speed and counts that I really, really like to. So I think for the most part, I did pretty good.
We're back with more Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haugh.
That was the voice of Nick Nastrini, the White Sox rookie right-hander, about his Major League debut on Monday night. Thank you to NBC Sports Chicago for that highlight. Coming back, David Haugh, Bruce Levine, Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. And now joining us on the Circus Sports Illinois hotline is Nick Nastrini. Download the Circus Sports app today. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
We're doing well. Thank you for joining us. I imagine it has been a whirlwind week. When you look back at Monday night and making the debut against the Royals, what stands out? How special was it?
It was a day that I dreamt of my entire life. And to be able to fulfill that dream, it was incredible. I mean, it was everything I hoped it to be, everything that I imagined. My expectations did not let me down. So, I mean, it was a fantastic night, and it was even better to have all my family and friends there. So that was a lot of fun.
So I guess, Nick, the next question is, once that part wears off, now you're in the major leagues, you're competing against the best players in the world. How do you take your next start going into Sunday and say, okay, I've pitched my whole life, I competed my whole life, I'm not going to let the moments get too big?
I mean, yeah, obviously we're playing the Phillies on Sunday, and it's really just about trusting yourself and trusting that you have the ability to go get those kind of level hitters out. Because, I mean, I feel like it would be pretty easy for a rookie to go out there and, you know, try to do a little bit more because of the caliber of hitters and the team that the Phillies are. But I just got to trust my stuff and trust that I'm good enough to go out there and you know, get the job done.
5 innings, 3 hits, 2 earned runs. You struck out 5, you walked 2. When you study that, when you watch the tape and you examine what you did well, what you need to do better, how did you break down your first major league appearance?
I got ahead of a lot of hitters, which is something that I have been working on for a long time, especially over the past 2.5 years in the minors, you know, just getting strike one. So that's very important, and getting the leadoff guy out as well. And for the most part, I did that really, really well. So there was a lot of positives, but there were some negatives. So, you know, I wasn't too good with my fastball, especially to when I gave up that homer, and then especially in the 5th inning when I had a few walks. So, you know, just making sure that I can stay sharp throughout the entire game and go out there and not make mistakes that get hurt.
You're traded from your dream team and where you were raised. And a 4th-round draft pick by the Dodgers last year. How quickly was it, were you able to turn around the disappointment from that of not being able to pitch for your hometown team and realize, hey, I'm going to be in the major leagues and maybe I'll be able to get to the major leagues quicker?
Right. I mean, the Dodgers were not my hometown team. The Padres are. So it wasn't too bad of a separation. I would say where I was more upset was the relationships that I had that I created with the Dodgers. I mean, I have some of my best friends are still with that organization. So I would say that was the tough part. But yeah, to your point, you know, I mean, being able to get to the major leagues faster and have a real chance to stick here. I mean, that's an absolutely insane opportunity to have, and maybe not one that I would have had with the Dodgers. So, I mean, I was looking at it with a glass half full kind of mentality, so I can, you know, not be too bummed about it and let that kind of transition, you know, maybe just spiral a little bit and have those like disappointments lead into negative performances on the field. So, I mean, I try to look at it with a little bit more glass half full mentality.
Talking with White Sox right-hander Nick Nastrini, the rookie who made his major league debut on Monday. It was followed on Tuesday by another major league debut by Jonathan Cannon for the White Sox. And, Nick, you and Jonathan Cannon became the first players to make back-to-back debuts as pitchers since 1932. So you've already made history as a member of the White Sox. Not sure if you were aware of that, but you and Jonathan Cannon seem to have developed a little early camaraderie. Have you guys talked about the history that you made?
Yeah, we have. Actually, him and I did not know that. Someone else came up and told us a few days ago. So, I mean, yeah, it was pretty cool. Jonathan's a guy that – he was actually the first guy that I talked to when I got traded. We were sitting in the dugout in Biloxi, Mississippi at the Brewers AA place, and he was the first person that I actually had a real conversation with the first day that I got there. So we quickly became friends. We were playing golf on our off days together, and we were going to get dinner afterwards. So we quickly became good friends. So to be able to experience this with him and to be able to experience him make his major league debut was insane.
What has your experience with Ethan Katz been like so far from spring training into now? Now you're pitching in the major leagues. What type of a coach is he verbally? What is he like as far as expectations go? What has that dynamic been like?
It's been very good. I really, really do like Ethan. He knows what he's talking about. He understands how the body is supposed to move. He understands how to game plan hitters. And he understands how to use your strengths to go ahead and get big league hitters out, because it's really easy. I've had some coaches that want you to pitch to the hitter's weaknesses rather than pitching to your strengths. So their weakness may not be your strength. So you don't do it very well. So he's been unbelievable. I have nothing but great things to say about him. And he's honestly made this transition to the big league the past week, and especially during spring training, very seamless. So I'm very thankful for him, because he's a very easygoing guy. He's understanding. He's easy to talk to, and he's easy to approach as well, which is something that I haven't really had with a lot of coaches.
Let's go back to spring training. It seemed like you made such a strong impression at Glendale that they were ready to move you up quicker than they did. You made your major league debut on Monday, but it seems like that was targeted earlier in the season. But did you come down with pneumonia? Was there something to that? You were ready to be called up or ready to be promoted, and you came down with pneumonia and ended up in the emergency room?
Yeah, I did. So the plan coming out of spring training was to stay in Arizona for an extra week and make one more start, just like in a sim game. So that, because if I went to Chicago with the team, I would have gone 12 days without facing hitters, and then I would have been thrown against the Braves, and not facing hitters for 12 days and then pitching against the Braves isn't really a recipe for success. So I was going to stay in Arizona for a week and pitch on that Wednesday, April 3rd. But on the day I was supposed to pitch in Arizona, I woke up with this excruciating pain in my side. And I went to the field, and the trainers at the field took me to the ER. They thought I initially had kidney stones, but they ran a CT scan, and they figured out that it was pneumonia. So after that little trip, I didn't really have any pain. It was more just like pretty brutal COVID symptoms for a couple of days, I would say. It was like headache, chills, difficulty breathing, just stuff like that. But yeah, I did get pneumonia, and it was a rough couple of days.
Wow.
It's like being in love for the first time, right? Same symptoms. And I'm not making light of it. It was probably a horrible experience. So glad you recovered from that. The elephant in the room we can't ignore, and that is, how do you deal as a teammate, as a rookie, and as somebody that's watching it every day, looking at your teammates on the field and really grabbing those bats on offense and squeezing the sawdust out of them to try to get a base hit? How difficult is that for you to watch, and how can you be a supportive teammate when you see these struggles?
I mean, everybody goes through it, I will say, whether that's a 0-for-15 slump or you're just barreling balls, but they're going right to people. I mean, I know how I mean, obviously I'm not a hitter, so I understand how it is. I don't really understand how it is as far as like a hitting perspective. But I have had the yips before. So I have gone out there and I have thrown the ball like 45 feet, 110 feet off the backstop and not know what was going on. So I understand what it feels like to go out there and, you know, feel a little helpless. But from my experience, it can be turned around so quick. So honestly, all I can really do is just be there to support my teammates and, you know, try to pick their brains, try to help them out. And hopefully my support helps them a little bit, but you just got to go out there and understand that this game is super hard. I mean, it's not easy. So I just got to be there for my teammates and be a good teammate and, you know, try to support them in the best way that I can.
Great attitude. So what can you tell us about your first major league road trip? How cool has that been? And have you had any moments you're like, you pinch yourself like, hey, I'm in the big leagues?
I mean, when I was younger, I would play MLB The Show, and my brother and I would pick the Philly Stadium every single time. So to be able to walk into that stadium, and I threw a bullpen yesterday and throw a bullpen at that stadium and look at that mound and say, like, holy cow, Roy Holiday pitched on that mound, is just like it's insane. So to be able to have this be my first road trip is pretty sweet. And then off the field, this bed that we have in our hotel is honestly the nicest hotel bed I've ever slept in.
Awesome.
That's pretty sweet. Yeah. And the city is pretty sweet as well. We were able to walk around a little bit yesterday and see what it has for us. But I mean, yeah, the road trip's pretty sweet.
Great perspective. Free advice, Nick. Kyle Schwarber has hit 251 career home runs by feasting on first pitch fastballs. So
thank you.
And by the way, he's a friend of ours, so I can text him and say, you know, maybe go easy, but I don't know if that's going to work. Anyways, thanks so much for this. Appreciate you coming on. You're a great communicator. All the best to you in your career. And Sunday it should be fun watching you go up against one of the better offenses in baseball.
Sweet. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Nick Nastrini, White Sox rookie right-hander, 24 years old, going on 35, Bruce. Mature young man.
Great interview.
Great interview, good presence of mind, and I think that kind of maturity is something that the Sox identified not only in the trade for him, or he was included in the trade, but they were ready to promote him and break camp with Nick Nastrini, if not for what we just heard, the bout with pneumonia.
So if you look at the opening day rotation for the White Sox, by the All-Star break, how many of those guys are going to be starting? And you know, again, you have some veterans coming along that are going to be there. Clevinger's going to be there. You have
Brad Keller.
Keller.
Possibly.
And then these young guys, which, you know, if we did a poll right now of White Sox fans, they would say, give us all those good young arms we can watch here. Why not use this opportunity to develop them at the major league level?
It's a good point, Bruce. 312-644-6767. Let's open up the phone lines. Sox fans, is that something that you've thought about? Also, the other thing, you talk about the elephant in the room, tough to watch the losing. The White Sox are on a collision course with the wrong kind of history. The 2003 Tigers, the 1962 Mets. Jason Stark, baseball historian in The Athletic, wrote about that comparison and with that pace that the Sox are on. And then people want to know, if you start out too poorly, that what are they, 3-15 right now? How long before change for the sake of change is a reality and you do change managers, even though it's not all Pedro's fault? It can't possibly be one guy's fault. So there's a lot to discuss. 312-644-6767.
Is there a Major League Baseball problem here, David? Because historically, we have a chance for the Colorado Rockies and the Miami Marlins, who are here facing the Cubs, to be right there. They're only a game or so better than the White Sox at 3-16. So historically, are we looking at some real discrepancy in the teams in the game right now? And are too many teams right now willing to be bad, you know, and accepting that? Moving forward here, waiting for expansion, waiting for the realignment of teams in baseball, which is sure to come within the next 4 years.
You might be able to make that argument in Oakland. You might be able to make the argument even in Miami. But I don't think you should ever be able to make the argument in Chicago.
Yeah,
I just don't
think. It's a fair point.
I don't think that we can have that conversation here or ever really should.
We've had a lot of rebuilds here, though, over the last 10 years.
We have.
This is, for Chicago fans, this is the third rebuild with the White Sox and Cubs combined since 2011. Ugh. Okay.
It's like Bob Verdi once said, city of broad shoulders and narrow trophy cases.
Actually, fourth. Are the Cubs twice, White Sox twice.
Let's go out to the phone lines. Our friend Mike is in Glencoe. Mike, good morning. Welcome to Inside the Clubhouse.
Boy, Bruce, I think you hit the nail on the head. It seems to me that the Sox are entering, or maybe already entered, into a baseball version of what the urban planners call the doom loop. It's a self-reinforcing cycle when losing shrinks the fan base, which prompts less investment in the team, which begets more losing and further decay of the fan base and even less investment in the team. It's self-reinforcing, and the cycle doesn't end until the team ultimately breaks. It's sold or it's moved. Am I being too pessimistic, or is that where the Sox are in right now? Because, frankly, I don't see any way out at this point with this guy in charge of the team.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the phone call. Bruce, you're going to see the signs at the ballpark.
Mean Jerry? Or...
I think selling the team. It's something that came up this week. It's something that will keep coming up until it's sold. It's just, is that the answer to this spiral that the Sox find themselves in the midst of?
If you look at the Miami situation since they expanded and came into the league in 1993, it's been one bad owner after another.
They won a title.
They've never won a division. They've won two World Series.
I know. I would take the two World Series.
They've never had consecutive years where they could celebrate. Every time they won the World Series, they shut it down.
Yeah.
Okay, so there should be some protection for fans against that.
Agree with that. Yeah. You should be able to have some sort of insulation from that.
I mean, they do. They have the right to spend or not to spend. Historically, you know, the Marlins never really connected with the Miami fan base. Can that happen here to the White Sox fan base? I don't know.
Ron is on the south side. Good morning, Ron. Welcome inside the clubhouse.
Hey, good morning, guys. Regarding the young pitcher, well, for the most part, that's all that we have to look forward to. But Kevin mentioned it earlier. We can't, and Dave, I told you and Mully the other day, but these young pitchers, we can't get ahead of ourselves. I mean, it's going to be some growing pain. So we're going to have to accept, yeah, we want to see them out there. That's how you have to learn how to pitch. But a more important thing, guys, compared to when the White Sox did the rebuild, like when they had Sales or some guy that they could trade. They have nobody. See, it is so unfortunate that, like, Tim Anderson just was able to go away for some money. You can't trade Yoan Moncada. So sometimes when you're in this position, you say, well, we got to rebuild, and you have some – the only person they had, guys – and I these pitchers are not going to bring them anything. They had their one trading piece. Dylan C. So that's why this is even more frustrating, because you can't look at a couple of players. And I know I've said this numerous times. I just had no idea that Andrew Benintendi would be this bad. But that's it, guys. It's going to be bad for a few years because they have nothing. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate the phone call. We will talk about Tim Anderson. He met the media in Chicago this week. And when we come back, TA's on the opposite side, Marlins against the Cubs today at Wrigley Field. We'll hear what he had to say and play a little chin music on Inside the Clubhouse. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
High and inside.
It's time for some chin music.
Hey, how about a warning?
Sure. Watch out you don't get killed.
Because sometimes in baseball, you've got to send a strong message, especially when someone has it coming. Each Saturday, David and Bruce come in high and tight with a response to something that deserves one, like this.
However they want to. You know, however they want to. It's not really, you know... know it to me. I just know, you know, that the last year that I spent there was tough, and then finally to be able to, you know, make it through and be on the other side, you know, I'm happy. I'm in a great place. You know, my smile's back, and I'm back to, you know, back on my journey.
Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 The Score. David Hall, Bruce Levine, little chin music. That was Tim Anderson, the shortstop for the Miami Marlins, opposite the Cubs today in a doubleheader. T.A. probably played both games of the doubleheader. He's their everyday shortstop, right? He's the guy that
kind of, maybe, sort of.
He is.
Hasn't done much there so far.
He's not done much there. What happened to his power? What happened to the pop in that bat, Bruce? Because it's missing.
I have my theory. It's not all just Tim Anderson starting to suck because he wanted to. He had significant leg injuries.
Okay.
Over a period of 2 years. Your power comes from your backside and your legs in baseball. It doesn't come from your arms. Very few arm hitters that have been big successful world baseball players for numerous years. In his case, I just think he lost his entire game with his legs. Speed, power, everything. Getting that back, it's going to be interesting to watch. Can he get that back? Can he generate the power in his bat from his legs? Can he regain the speed that made him a threat to steal 25 bases every year? Can he just be the baseball athlete that he was? And in that soundbite, you heard him allude to a question about whether or not how the White Sox fans should perceive his time with the White Sox. How do you perceive it?
I think that, like everything else, it was great when he was succeeding and mysterious when he failed. And I think when you look back 3 years ago this August, it was the homer in the cornfields. And Joe Buck told a national television audience and baseball fans everywhere that this man, Tim Anderson, should be the face of baseball. And since that moment, you can draw a line. There, things have not gone up from there. They have been steadily downward. And I don't understand why the spiral occurred. I think he was responsible for some of it, maybe most of it, much of it. He owned the decisions that he made in his personal life, affected him professionally, maybe in terms of focus or otherwise. But I think when you talk about when you see Tim Anderson gathering a group of familiar Chicago media at Wrigley Field the other day, Bruce, I watched that with a tinge of sadness because this is somebody that I did come to respect and even like. The bat flip mentality, all the charisma, got to know him a little bit off the field, did a couple events with Tim Anderson and his wife at the time. I'm not sure if he's still married to her, but I think they were a bright young couple. And I think that you feel a little sad when you see Tim Anderson where he is at the stage of his career.
Well, he did a lot of good things for charities in Chicago.
Yes, he did.
And for that, I will always have a fond feeling for him because he tried to do the right things. He did do the right things. Putting yourself in the position, David, as the face of a sport, whether you allow that to happen, other people talking about it or you, is an impossibility to me. I mean, injury has taken away a lot of his game, but the reality of being on video games, being highlighted in commercials, being the new face of fun in baseball. At the time when he decided to do the bat flips and get in the face of opponents, baseball was considered extremely boring at the time. We were going through a phase where people were having a hard time watching the game. Over the past couple of years, there's been a resurgence of, hey, these games are only 2.5 hours. They're watchable again. They've changed the rules. They've also changed some of their approach. It's a better game. But Tim has kind of been left behind in that new era of baseball. And I just wonder how difficult it is for an athlete to put himself out there as the new face of a sport and be able to live up to it.
Well, especially when he's not the one who did that. I think what happens is that I know he embraced being that guy, or he was the one who
he
was
did.
He had the swagger, and he carried himself in such a way. But, Bruce, when you do that, you don't necessarily invite what comes next. You're just being true to who you think you are. And Tim Anderson's personality maybe did invite some of those things.
But, you know, but, saying the unwritten rules of baseball don't exist for him, okay? They exist, and they continue to exist 150 years later since they started out.
Praise can be heavy, and not everybody's equipped to carry that burden. And Tim Anderson, with praise like Joe Buck heaped on him, like praise like we all did at one point in time, said he is the face of the White Sox. He is the leader in the clubhouse. You know, he was certainly the most flamboyant player that they had, but flamboyance doesn't guarantee, you know, or even assure anything of baseball maturity. And I just don't know if he was ready for what came with all of the praise, what came with the designation as team leader. Some guys are made a cutout for that. Some guys aren't. And that's okay. That's okay. But I think that there was too much expected of Tim Anderson, and he just couldn't handle the weight of it.
You know, when your stuff is out on the street about your personal life, not too many people can hold up to that in this day and age, okay?
It's tough.
Social media, if Tim Anderson was going through this 15 years ago, it would have been a lot smoother sailing for Tim Anderson than people knowing whether he had a girlfriend, a wife, that things weren't going right for him, that he had multiple injuries, that he wasn't the player that he was. It's a lot on a young man, you know, and you feel for him as a person, but as an analyzing sports, you know, most fans don't really care. Okay, they want to know why you're not producing, and if you're not going to, who's going to replace you?
The Sox didn't decline his $14 million option because he had issues off the field. They declined his $14 million option because he stopped hitting, and he was one of the worst shortstops in baseball last year on an everyday basis. And frankly, if you're starting to move on and start anew, you start to unload things that are expendable. And Tim Anderson made himself expendable by being bad. He was bad last year, Bruce, and he was given the benefit of the doubt because of what he had accomplished previous to that.
It's amazing how quickly people can – I mean, I think back to Addison Russell with the Cubs and how important he was for them and how some things that he did off the field certainly impacted his career to the point where his career disappeared.
Disappeared. He's playing in Mexico.
In thin air.
Thin air. Now, he did that. Okay. I understand the comparison because we're talking about two once all-star caliber Chicago shortstops. But I do want to caution people. Do not make that comparison. I don't think that what Addison Russell did, that was self-inflicted. That was totally self-inflicted. And what Tim Anderson did was maybe he was not up to the task of handling a lot of the attention that came his way and made some bad decisions that created some professional problems because of his personal life. But I just feel like the Addison Russell issue gets messy when you start to look into it. But it is a good example about how quickly
I'm not comparing the experience. I'm comparing how quickly
it can things unravel.
And especially social media and the pressure that has on people.
That's a good point.
I mean, it's you can't stand up to
Addison Russell will be the answer to a trivia question that stumps everybody in 10 years. Who was the starting shortstop on the Cubs World Series champions? And do you think anyone's going to come up with that one?
It's going to be difficult.
Because, like, oh, wait, who was that guy? When was he here? Oh, him? Oh, was he the guy that... Oh, him.
Oh, yeah, Baez. Yeah, that's the guy that Baez replaced.
But, yes, replaced.
Right.
Everybody thinks Javi Baez was the starting shortstop of that team. And you look at Addison Russell's ascension with the Cubs and his fall from grace, and it was very sudden, swift, and self-inflicted, but it's a very interesting comparison.
In the bigger picture, David, succeeding in sports these days with the extra pressure out there, everybody is impacted by social media, no question about it. If you try to turn it off, then you're also not facing the reality of what life is right now. Maybe as an athlete, you know, I ask a lot of players about social media, and they say, You know, I look at it, but I certainly do not communicate with people on it.
Smart.
Yeah.
You get dragged down with a lot of people. It is where context goes to die. That's always the thing that you say about social media. Texter checks in. Baseball is 90% mental. Tim Anderson has to try to rebuild his own character, own up, and move forward. I think he's trying to do that, Bruce. I'm pulling for Tim Anderson. I'm a fan of Tim Anderson. But I think as you were there in front of him on Thursday, would you agree that he is taking responsibility for his missteps and he's ready to move forward?
But you know what? The pushback that he gave me personally in a couple of questions, I liked. Because it was like, hey, don't take me back down into that hole. I'll answer a couple questions about it. Don't ask me a second and third question about it. I've moved on, okay? My therapy or the people I talk to insist that I stay in the moment right now. I don't go back down that hole. I don't try to revisit something that is not going to benefit me thinking about moving forward. And it's a life lesson as well as it is a sports lesson.
He looked healthier and he sounded healthier, and that's good to see because I hope he has success in Florida or wherever he ends up finding it. Join the Score in Budweiser Thursday, May 2nd at Harry Carey's Tavern in Navy Pier for the 26th annual worldwide toast to Harry Carey. Parkins and Spiegel, they'll be there, broadcasting live from 4 to 7 with actor and comedian Jason Alexander leading the toast at 5:30. Wow, George Costanza's in town. You'll also have a chance to register to win tickets to a future Cubs home game. The Worldwide Toast to Harry Carey is brought to you by Budweiser. This Bud's for you. When you come back, we're going to hear what D'Ansby Swanson had to say about the value of team camaraderie next Inside the Clubhouse. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
We're back with more Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haw.
Welcome back. It's Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Ninth inning, going to have to close here. Let's hope we don't blow it, Bruce. So, D'Ansby Swanson, leader of the Cubs, one of those guys that people turn to, including front office personnel, in times of, well, times any time, really, because he's always got something to say. His baseball sensibility is good, exceptional even. And you had a conversation with him about some things that go on off the field or have gone on off the field with the Cubs that he thinks might be related to why they have had a pretty good start.
This is actually from the post game yesterday. He talked to me and a couple other media people, and he was asked about the fact, how close is this team? And did you guys really go out together in Seattle as an entire group?
We had over 20 guys there. Some people had, you know, friends in town or whatever and weren't able to make it. But, yeah, getting together as a group is always fun. We always had a saying that good teams hang out together, you know. And just being able to get away, spend an off day, you know, going to dinner, get a nice dinner, hang out with everybody and, like, kind of, not necessarily let your guard down, but be able to, you know, be in a room and all eat together and just enjoy that time together. It's so much fun. And you know, that's what usually people remember most, right, when they get done playing. It's just those times spent with one another. And so, you know, it was such an awesome time for all of us to get together.
That's really something that the Cubs have been very good at the last couple of years. I don't know if it coincides. Every team has these moments. But last year, remember, I think it was D'Ansby Swanson talking about a moment in San Francisco that kind of started a change in their season. The team doesn't always have to get along. Ozzie Guillen will say he doesn't. You know, he'll be the first to tell you you don't always have to like your teammates or the players you manage. But I think it does help.
So when you give out the second largest contract in the history of the franchise to a guy like Swanson, who is a part of a great organization, the Atlanta Braves, a team that won a World Series, how much of the equation is involved in, oh, yeah, he's going to play shortstop for us the next 7 years, but he has these great leadership abilities. He's a great teammate. He's going to be somebody that we can help build a culture around as well.
Huge factor. Had to be a huge factor. And when you go back to that winter, he was always considered, well, there's three other shortstops that are really better hitters. Then there's D'Ansby Swanson. He's good with the glove and some intangibles. Doesn't hit a lot, but. And I know that there's some people that you hear from during the week. I'm sure you interact with them. Dansby Swanson needs to hit more. Dansby Swanson needs to stop booting ground balls. Boy, do you know how many errors he has already? I get it, because he's making all the money. But I also think that what you just said underscores why he was the right guy for the Cubs and why they're willing to pay him for all. It's like a personal services contract. Yeah, you need to be a Gold Glove shortstop. He was. Yeah, you need to hit better than you are. He knows that. But you know what? You're the guy that's a glue. You're going to keep everything together and give teammates reasons or teammates somewhere they can look to when they're looking for a boost.
Why him and not Carlos Correa? And those are the reasons. The reasons are Correa might have the same leadership ability, but he's on the field about 50% of the time. This guy, you have to force him to sit down, okay? He doesn't want to come out. You look at his career, he might have missed 20 games in 5 years, okay? He just plays every day. The conversation was, and still is, how can we keep him fresh because he wants to play every day?
Especially after last September.
Right. Yeah,
especially after last September.
And, you know, all the players crashed last September. You know, they were all worn out from having to go, go, go because of the fact they were 10 games under 500 as late as June. So from that perspective, you know, these type of leaders, you know, the Jameson Taillons of the world as well, you know, you come in, you're an important pitcher, but Swanson said yesterday, you know, there's very few people or teammates I've ever had that are as great as Jameson Taillon. Okay, so this is a part of what incorporates a team being successful both on and off the field.
No doubt about it. And today, Dansby Swanson in game one of the doubleheader, batting fourth, playing shortstop familiarly. Let's look at that lineup, Bruce. Nico Hoerner leading off, playing second. Patrick Wisdom, you said he was the right fielder? He's in right field today.
Left-handed pitcher.
Christopher Morel is the DH. Dansby Swanson, as we said, shortstop batting cleanup. Garrett Cooper in the lineup as a first baseman. Mike Tauchman is in center field. Nick Madrigal is at third base. Miguel Amaya catching. And Alexander Canario is in left field. Javier Assad pitching. Bears. Bruce, where's Belly? Where's
left-handed pitcher.
He could hit lefties.
Doubleheader. You're going to make him play a doubleheader? Which game do you want him to play, against the lefty or the righty?
Both.
Okay.
Who?
Both. You would get fired in midseason as a manager. Your guys would all be burned out.
Isn't that what Scott Boras said? You're going to pay him a lot?
26-man roster.
A little early to belly up to the bar.
There are a lot of opportunities for guys that don't play every day in that first game.
I suppose, but this is one of the oddest lineups yet of the Craig Counsell era. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. They're playing well. He knows what he's doing.
He's
going
to be happy to hear that.
I don't think he cares about whether we're giving him the benefit of the doubt.
No, you, not me.
Okay.
Let's not go from me to we.
That's the lineup in the pregame right here on the Score at 12:45 with Zach and then Pat and Ron. They are on a roll. They're having a great year.
Always
so are you, Bruce.
Fun listening.
This has been a lot of fun today.
Absolutely. People can follow me at Twitter at MLB Bruce Levine on our website, writing Cubs and Sox every day, 670thescore.com. We give thanks very much to Patrick Wisdom of the Cubs for joining us, Nick Mastrini joining us from the White Sox, our great producer, Tyler.
Tyler Farengold did a great job, and Bruce, you'll appreciate this. It was 9 years ago today we lost a legend, and it's a tough anniversary every April 20th, but Doug Buffone passed away 9 years ago today. We still miss you, Big Doug. Still thinking about you, and life's never been the same
next
since.
Next week, I'll be listening to our great draft show, the great draft weekend, the biggest week in Chicago sports history in years, right?
In a long time. Bruce,
yeah,
you are
so
a pro.
I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Great segue, because draft coverage here on The Score presented by ChevyDriveChicago.com, the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. For Bruce Levine, Tyler Farengold, I'm David Haw. Thank you for listening to Inside the Clubhouse. Grody time next on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.